The novelist Don DeLillo writes of a man who's growing uncomfortable. Everything he sees reminds him of swiftly passing time.
A taxi meter, an appointment, a cell phone, all of that is a measurement of time that tends to make him anxious.
That man is a central character in the latest work by a leading American writer. In past novels, Don DeLillo reimagined John F. Kennedy's assassination, the Cold War, even 9/11. His new novel, called Point Omega, also seems to dwell on public events, though it centers on that one anxious man. Richard Elster flees alone to a house in the middle of the California desert. He flees because he feels the ticking of mortality.
Out in the desert, what he feels is so vast that it doesn't necessarily affect him personally.
Well, you present us with this gray-haired, sort of ponytailed university intellectual thinking really big thoughts in a really big place, and yet he's also remembering or recovering from a really specific recent news event.
You're referring to the war.
This is a man you describe as having been an intellectual who was brought into an administration to help plan what appears to be the Iraq War.
He was, he was part of a series of closed meetings in conference rooms. And what he was intended to contribute was a kind of overarching view, not of specific troop movements, but to give them a deeper idea of how to wage this particular kind of war. And it gives him something to be in retreat from, that is, his experience during those 2 years or so that he spent as a defense intellectual. And his retreat occurs in this desert terrain.
Mm-hmm. And you create a filmmaker who comes to see him, wants to get him to make a film, which, well, at one point, the main character, Elster, describes it as a confession. He basically says, "You want a confession from me."
This is what Jim Finley probably intends. He wants a man against the wall. He wants a man standing and talking. He wants a face on the screen. And if Elster decides to veer in his monologue from Iraq to any other subject, young Jim Finley is happy to film it. He believes that on film, the face is the soul. He calls it a primal film. And this is what he hopes Elster will agree to do.
What do you think draws you as a writer who's concerned with really large themes of time and life and death to focus on people who have some connection to public news events?
I think for decades now we've been flooded by media stimulation of one kind or another. And once it becomes part of everybody's life, I think it becomes part of a fiction writer's conceivable subject, at least at some level. It has just seemed to me to be an important element in our lives. And I guess, in one sense, my work all these years has been about living in dangerous times. And part of this danger has been what the media reports and how it changes our perceptions.
I'm thinking of a novel of yours that must be more than a quarter century old now, White Noise. I still remember a passage from that book, which I relate to now as a parent, in that there's a father and a son. They're driving in a car. It's dumping down rain. The son says, you're smiling, I'm glad you remember this too. The son says, the radio says it's going to rain tonight. The father says it's raining now. The son says, the radio said tonight. You have this conflict between reality and virtual reality.
Yeah, and the conflict is, I think, ever-present. It's something that we breathe in through our pores. It's just part of our perception.
Do you feel you have some of the same obsessions as you did many years ago when you were writing your early work?
I think I have the same obsessions. I'm not sure I could state them clearly. I think they involve danger and, to some extent, violence and people moving towards some sort of inevitability, perhaps.
Some sort of inevitability, meaning death, I suppose.
That's at the end of everything, yes. And I think that's ultimately what shapes my work and, in a sense, maybe what shapes most art.
Because you've written so much about death or people who seem in some way to be anxious about or fearing death, I wonder how your own thoughts on that subject have evolved as you yourself have grown older.
I'm still 22 in my mind. When I'm walking along a street, I'm not a novelist of a certain age. I'm just the same guy I always was. That's how I feel. I don't feel different. I'm not aware that I think different. I don't think about these matters in a very conscious way.
You don't think about them in a conscious way, and yet they keep coming out on the page.
Well, there it is. That's what writers do, I suppose. We do express ourselves, but we don't necessarily do it in the first person. We don't necessarily do it as autobiography. It simply flows out of us and into characters.
When I think about the work that you've done over the last many years, some of your characters have families, some do not. Some are deeply engaged in the world. In this case, you have a man who's withdrawn to the desert and gotten as disengaged from the world as he could. And yet, it seems to me that no matter what their circumstance, a great many of your main characters are basically lonely, if not alienated from the world.
I think this is probably true, and in some of them, in earlier novels, tend to be men in small rooms. And in Elster's case, it's a man in a vast desert, but essentially the same kind of situation.
What draws you to that alienation?
There's no simple answer to that question. It certainly isn't an autobiographical aspect of my fiction. But there's something about a single individual, isolated from the world, that appeals to me as a writer. Everything funneled into one man in one room. You know, it's not something I try to explain to myself. It's just a feeling, and it's something I'm driven toward.
Don DeLillo's new novel is called Point Omega. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
In her new novel, Shadow Tag, writer Louise Erdrich turns a diary into a deadly device to bring about the final collapse of a marriage. As is often the case in Erdrich's books, her main characters are Native American. But in this novel, their ancestry is mostly a backdrop for a shattering family drama that leaves no one unscathed. NPR's Lynn Neary has more.
The story of Irene America and her husband Gil is a tough one. Married with three children, their lives are tied together domestically and professionally. Irene is a scholar who can't seem to finish her thesis. Her husband Gil is a Native American artist famous for his portraits of his wife. Gil's volatile temper keeps the children in a constant state of fearful watchfulness, wondering if and when the family will fall apart. As Louise Erdrich tells it, Shadow Tag is a book she had to write.
I found myself writing about this without really wanting to. It was an insistent book, and there were times where I really dreaded going up to keep going on it, but it was as though I couldn't stop.
Though Erdrich says the book is not based on her own life, there are echoes of her life in it. During the 1980s, Erdrich and writer Michael Doris were a literary golden couple. Doris, who was also part Native American, was her mentor and then her literary partner. Together, they helped put Native American literature on the map. They were also the parents of six children, three adopted, three biological. The couple's public image began to fall apart when one of their adopted sons accused them of child abuse. Then, in 1996, Doris was accused of sexually abusing at least one of his daughters. Just before he was expected to be formally charged, Doris committed suicide. Erdrich says as she wrote Shadow Tag, she knew comparisons to her own life were inevitable.
I thought about it all through the book. That's why it's constructed in a way that I felt as though I moved it farther and farther from my personal reality. By the end of the book, I didn't feel that it had a bearing on it.
I guess whatever anybody writes really has something drawn from their own personal experience. You know, it reflects something that you have some knowledge of.
Well, I think people who write store up their emotions and use their emotional experiences almost as a sort of currency from one book to the next. But, you know, I've had so many experiences by now that I have a lot to draw on. I'm 55, and what happened in my marriage happened quite some time ago. And I think if I was going to write about it directly, I would have done so right afterward.
The central device in the book, a fake diary, is drawn from Erdrich's life. As the book begins, Irene discovers that Gil has been reading her diary. So she starts a new one in which she writes the truth. She fills the one that Gil reads with untruths and half-truths that instill him with doubts about her fidelity. Erdrich says when she was in college, someone read her diary, and that is when she first had the idea of planting a false diary. Erdrich, who has kept diaries all her life, says she thinks of them as sacred.
I think one keeps a diary after a time imagining that nobody would ever violate it. It seems unthinkable, so that when it happens, it's a great breach of trust.
In this passage, read by Erdrich, Irene first realizes that her husband has invaded her privacy.
Gil turned back to Stoney. How is your Black Bear project coming? It's not black bears, Daddy. Oh, it's not? What is it? Wolves. Irene's fork paused over a crescent of Bosque pear. She put her fork down beside her plate. Wolves. Black bears. She'd made the same mistake in her diary and written it down. She sat there staring at her plate for so long that Gil looked at her. She was breathing quickly. Are you all right? I don't feel well, said Irene.
As Irene manipulates Gil's emotions with her false diary, the tension in the household begins to spin out of control. When the end comes, it is both surprising and shocking. Erdrich says she thinks of the book as a psychological thriller.
I was, I suppose you'd say, addicted to the writing of this book, so I wanted it to be a kind of addictive book in which the reader needed to know immediately what happened to the persons in it, in which they became fascinated with the people and wanted to know how this was all going to turn out. I think from the first page you wonder, how can this possibly turn out? What's going to happen to these people? How are the children going to make it? Will they make it?
And so you wanted it to be something of a page-turner then?
Exactly. I always want the books to be page-turners. I love having stories where people want to know the endings. That's the kind of book I like reading. Maybe I'm not a very intellectual reader at all. I like stories.
Shadow Tag, says Erdrich, has no message. It's simply a story she felt compelled to write. And if it weren't for Erdrich's gift for storytelling, this tale of a marriage gone wrong might be hard to take. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Seventy years ago, Britain was at war with Nazi Germany. The policy of appeasing Adolf Hitler had failed, the old appeasers were out of power, and Winston Churchill was in. The U.S. was not in. President Franklin D. Roosevelt was aiding the British, but as for actually going to war, he faced a skeptical Congress. As London endured devastating German bombing raids, some Americans were there, assuring the Brits of American support and agitating for U.S. entry into World War II. Lynn Olson has written a book about three of those Americans. Citizens of London is about two men I've read a lot about. There was the fabled CBS reporter Edward R. Murrow, who told Americans what living through the Blitz was like.
Earlier this evening, we heard a number of bombs go sliding and slithering across to fall several blocks away.
And there was the playboy industrialist turned diplomatic troubleshooter, Averill Harriman, who was in London to expedite U.S. military aid.
Well, it was an extraordinary experience. I don't believe ever in the history of a nation been so united, men, women, and children, on only one purpose, to stand together under the inspired leadership of Winston Churchill.
And then there is the forgotten member of Lynn Olson's trio.
The newly appointed American ambassador to Britain, Mr. John G. Wynant, arrives in England by air from Lisbon and is met by the Duke of Kent. Here are his first words on arrival.
I haven't much to say. I'm very glad to be here. There's no place I'd rather be at this time than in England.
Lynn Olson, that was John Gilbert Wynant, Gil Wynant, arriving in England. And when he said there was no place he would rather be at that time, what was London like at that time?
London had been bombed for the previous 8 months. It had gone through the Blitz. Most Americans who had been there had already left. Gil Winant came to replace Joseph Kennedy as ambassador and made very, very clear from the beginning he wanted to be there with the British.
Ambassador Kennedy, the father, of course, of President John F. Kennedy, he had not just left, he had left very flamboyantly and with no hope for the English.
Joseph Kennedy was not a favorite of the British people, to put it mildly. He was for appeasement. He went back to Washington to tell Roosevelt that he thought the British were going to be defeated and that America shouldn't help them.
So FDR replaces him with Gil Winant. Who was Gil Winant?
Gil Winant was the former governor of New Hampshire. He was a liberal Republican. He supported social reform. In fact, he was a big advocate of FDR and the New Deal. He actually sacrificed his political career for Roosevelt and the New Deal.
He comes to a city that is being bombed, a capital of a country that has already withdrawn from the continent. And like Murrow, he wanders the streets at night during the Blitz. He talks to the Londoners as, in fact, they're under attack.
It was extraordinary. Yes, as soon as he arrived, he would go out on the streets of London while bombs were falling, and he would ask people that he ran into, that he encountered, what he could do to help, which was amazing to the British people. His warmth and his compassion and his determination to stand with them and share their dangers was the first tangible sign for a lot of the British that America and its people really cared about what happened to them. So he really became a symbol of the best side of America.
And indeed, he was an advocate within the Roosevelt administration for getting into the war.
Oh, very, very strongly. From the time he went over there, both he and Averell Harriman were badgering Roosevelt and other administration officials that England had to be saved and that America had to get in the war. Absolutely.
To say that these three Americans, Winant, Murrow, and Harriman, were close to Churchill would be the understatement of all times. Harriman has an open affair,
right,
encouraged by Churchill, with Churchill's own daughter-in-law while his son is off fighting in the war. Later, when Harriman is sent to Moscow as the U.S. ambassador, she, Pamela Harriman, Pamela Churchill, takes up with Edward R. Murrow for a while. And Winant, the ambassador, is having an affair with Sarah Churchill, the prime minister's married daughter.
London was extraordinary that way during the war. It was really a hothouse. You know, it's like covering a presidential campaign. I think being in a war situation can be a real aphrodisiac. It's everybody is thrown together. And things happen that normally don't happen. Churchill actually invested a lot in these three men. He courted them as relentlessly as he was going to court Roosevelt later on in the war. And so he drew them into his official family. He gave them tremendous access to himself and to other members of his government. But he also made them part of his own family. Winant and Harriman, in particular, spent many, many weekends with the Churchills. And so, therefore, they really became close in every possible respect.
After the war, Edward R. Murrow goes on to run CBS News, take on Senator Joseph McCarthy, join the Kennedy administration. Averell Harriman becomes a cabinet secretary, governor of New York, very ill-starred presidential aspirant in the Democratic Party. Winant has a very sad end after the war.
Winant was Roosevelt's man. His whole life was bound up with Franklin Roosevelt. And when Roosevelt died in April 1945, it was really the end in many ways for John Gilbert Winant. The Republicans no longer wanted him. He hoped that he was going to become Secretary General of the new UN, but that didn't happen when Roosevelt died. His affair with Sarah Churchill ended badly. He was an exhausted, sick man at the end of the war. And in fact, less than 2 years after the war, he killed himself.
In a way, his story proves the flip side of the aphrodisiac, as you say, and the adrenaline high that living in a war is. At the end of the war, there's no more adrenaline, there's no more energy, there's no more excitement in life for him.
Absolutely. And for quite a number of people, that was true. The war was the most exciting, the biggest thing that happened in the lives of many, many people. As horrible as it was, it meant everything to many, many people. And Gil Winant was one of those. There was a sense of exhaustion on the part of virtually everybody who had played a role, a significant role in the war, military or civilian. And when it was over, the after effect was very painful for a lot of people.
While reading your book, I took an informal poll of politically smart people I know who are of my generation, that is, born shortly after the war, or maybe 10 years after the war, to ask if they'd heard of Winant. And nobody had heard of him. I didn't know about Winant. Maybe I'd seen his name here or there, but I had no sense of how important a character this was. He disappeared in history.
He really did, and that's a terrible thing, I think, because he was really a major architect of the Anglo-American alliance. He played a huge role in keeping it together, in kind of helping the British and Americans get along during the war. And to have him disappear so completely, I think, it is really wrong. And I think it's important to restore him to the place in American history that he really deserves.
Lynn Olson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Lynn Olson's book is called Citizens of London: The Americans Who Stood with Britain in Its Darkest, Finest Hour. Our book reviewer, Alan Chews, is no doctor, but he does have a cure for the winter blues, a healthy dose of science fiction. Here's his prescription.
Are you suffering from sleepless nights? Charlie Houston's new novel, Sleepless, may be just what you need to get through the dark. Sleepless is about an insomnia plague spreading across Southern California and the rest of the country. The disease first keeps you awake and after a couple of months kills you. It's turned L.A. upside down, causing riots and gun battles in the streets and driving even the healthy toward the brink. Meanwhile, a big pharma company seems to have developed a drug called Dreamer. It's a very expensive treatment for the disease, if not a full cure, and everybody wants it. Enter a police detective named Parker, whose wife is suffering from the disease, leaving the care of their small child mostly to him, and charging him with the hope that he can find some Dreamer to help her condition. If following Parker on his dangerous quest to find the drug doesn't keep you awake, and I really think it will, you can pick up the new Douglas Preston novel, Impact, in which human beings find themselves threatened at the planet level by strange bombardments coming from the direction of Mars. The science laced through this story comes right out of today's science news. I had a lot of fun following an American intelligence freelancer named Wyman Ford and a college-bound female science student from the jungles of Cambodia to the barren islands off the coast of Maine as they joined forces to try and head off the menace from outer space. Well, I said, you can pick up this new one. If you love this variety of narrative fiction, you will and should do it. Night is coming.
The books are Sleepless by Charlie Houston and Impact by Douglas Preston. Our reviewer is Alan Chews.